listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Well, we're always blessed with our guests, and our guests often come from recommendations from listeners, and so it was with our next guest. And my producer, Beck, said, oh, just write down a few notes about what you've done. Oh, my goodness. Amazing. We're talking to Lindsay Walker. Good morning, Lindsay.
Hello, Rodney. Lovely to talk to you.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. I don't quite know where to begin, but I know in a way where it ends up. And so I'll tease listeners with that. You set up an orphanage in Uganda.
Yes.
Like, that's a remarkable thing to do. The only thing I know about Uganda is Idi Amin.
Right.
Which isn't a pleasant thing to know about Uganda. So I'm wanting to hear all about Uganda and how a boy from Southland ends up setting an orphanage there.
Well, like so many things.
Let's start right at the beginning.
Okay.
Because you've had a – we were just talking off air, Lindsay and I, and everyone's life is interesting. And I've never actually met a boring person, funnily enough, once you get talking to them. And Lindsay, you've led a very interesting life. You're a Southland boy.
Yes, I am. Born and bred in Invercargill.
In 1952.
A long time ago, Rodney.
It was a long time ago. I was born in 1956.
Right.
So what did your dad do?
My dad was a watchmaker. But he worked for a company called Bath & Sons. They were a garage in Yarrow Street. But he was a watchmaker. He served in the Second World War on Espiritu Santos, which is in the Solomon Islands. And he basically did a lot of work on the American aircraft that were flying in the Coral Sea.
Whoa.
And he used to make watches and repair watches and cuckoo clocks and all those sorts of things. And I always used to try to do my thing by helping him, which, of course, was always probably didn't help him very much by putting all the little wheels and the little screws in the wrong places. But he was a great man. And
so he started out life as a watchmaker, but yes, then worked on cars and...
No, he's an accountant at Bath & Sons. He is actually in the office doing office work.
Oh, wow. But watchmaking was a sideline, like he did it for fun.
Yeah, yes, in later life, but he was more an instrumentalist, like as far as repairing instruments on aircraft as well. So whether he had formal training or just basically because he was a watchmaker was co-opted into the Air Force. I know he went to Wigram and places like that as well. So yeah, it's quite interesting.
Have you got a service record?
I would have. I'd have to look it up, but yes, okay. I'd have to look it up.
Because yeah. So interesting. Now, at the time when we were kids, we didn't have much interest in our dad's and our uncle's war service, but as you get older, you get fascinated by it.
You do indeed. Yeah, the other thing, just sidetracking ever so slightly, I was looking through their genealogy and going back into my dad's side, and my mother's side's really, really interesting because we can actually go back 72 generations. And I find
that's almost
that
Abraham. 72, that's biblical.
Just about.
72 generations. Let's think about that. Four generations a century.
Yeah.
Fours into 71, carry the three. Fours into 32 is eight. That's 1,800 odd years.
Yes, it is. It goes way, way back, a long, long way. And
no I'm way.
Also, yeah, and actually related to King Henry VIII. I was, I can't say this on air, but I was an illegitimate child of Henry VIII, apparently. And, the line is very, very fascinating. It goes through kings and queens, and some were beheaded, and some were put in jail, and some were executed, and goodness knows what. So it sort of goes through France, it goes through England, it goes through Wales. Very, very fascinating.
So it must have been your mother's side, it must have been back then nobility.
Yes.
To track so far, right?
Yeah. Well, the child who was illegitimate to Henry VIII couldn't have any title, but Henry VIII, in fact, paid for him to go to school and go through whatever college or university was at the time. So he
wasn't. So there's a little bit of Henry VIII in you.
Very, very small amount, although I do enjoy Welsh choirs, so there's a bit of Welsh in me as well.
But Henry VIII was what, 1500 and something, 1600 and something?
Yes, yes.
You go back over 1,000 years before that.
That's right. Yeah, it goes back to about 1200 or 900 AD, I think it was. Which is quite interesting. You could actually go all the way back to Noah if you really wanted to. I think somebody has actually done that.
900? So let's think 900 AD. Were they living in England or in France?
It was getting into more the French side, but they were in England, I think, around about that time as well. But it was fascinating because you could go on the father's side quite easily, but the mother's side, they didn't always record the actual wife or the partner. So it got quite hairy. On my father's side, I could go back to 1555, and then it stopped, and I couldn't go any further. But on my mother's side, because of the nobility, you could actually go back quite way. And the records were very, very good. Photographs were very good as well. Yeah, some of them are quite amazing.
My mother's ancestry was German.
Right.
And her surname was Pethig, P-E-T-H-I-G.
Mm-hmm.
And I tracked that down and ended up meeting Pethigs in England and then Pethigs in Germany. And the English Pethigs didn't know the German Pethigs existed.
Right.
We never knew we were German because I think in World War I it sort of dropped away as a thing. And I met up with German Pethigs in Germany and their father, who, as I explained, was a Nazi. He served in World War I, became a Nazi, was too elderly to fight in World War II, but was in banking and had been sort of some sort of banker in occupied Poland, I believe.
Gosh.
And then had to fled with his wife and children back to Germany when things turned south in World War II.
Mm.
He had spent his latter years tracing the Pethigs. And so I have that line back to sort of 1400. And the church had burnt down. And so the records didn't go previous to that.
Mm.
And there were like six or seven generations where a son would be born that gave rise to me. And he would grow up, get married, have children and die. And they'd record what he left. And it'd be a pot and a bed.
Yes.
And the next one would be two pots and one bed, and then no bed and three pots. That was basically what they had at the end of their working lives. And they lived for six or seven generations in a little farm net in Germany. And they were sort of tutors to the peasant kids. That was their job. They were peasants, but tutored the peasants' kids for six or seven generations.
Wow.
Pretty mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing.
I tell you the freaky thing about it was, I'm fascinated by World War II. Mm. And I read everything I can. And when I was in England and Germany, it felt very real to me. It felt like yesterday, you're walking the places. I visited on my own as many of the grave sites and battle sites I could, and without exception, I just bore my eyes out.
Yes, yes.
And when I met the English Pethigs, they got out their albums, and there were their young boys all dressed up heading off to war.
Yes.
And when I met the German Pethigs, this elderly lady who was the widow of the Nazi, she got out her album,
mm.
all these young boys dressed for war.
Gosh.
They were the pictures they had.
Yeah. Wow.
And they were literally cousins fighting each other in the most horrific
conditions.
Yeah, cousins, brothers. Two brothers. One brother went to London and one brother stayed in Germany.
Yes.
And then subsequently two sons, one son came to New Zealand. So you grew up in Southland and you went to school in Southland in the 60s.
Yes. Went to, started at Newfield, which was a primary school, went to Tweedsmuir, which is now Southland Girls High, but it was in those days was Tweedsmuir Intermediate, and then went to Southland Boys High.
So did you enjoy your childhood there?
Yes, I did. It was Southland Boys, I think, was probably more memorable, but I also had some very good teachers, and the teachers were really caring teachers in those days.
We had great teachers when you look back.
Yeah, and I always remember Miss Oates. She was the my form teacher at Tweedsmuir, and she would actually, she's quite young, I suppose she'd be 24, 25 maybe. And one day she said, right, we're going to go to the park. So she took everybody to the park, and out of her own money, she bought all these lollies and ice creams for the whole class. It must have cost her a fortune. And the rugby park store was on the corner at those days. It was right opposite the rugby park ground where it is today. And I think they thought all their Christmases had come at once because all these children were coming in for ice creams and lollies. And we sat in the park for 2 or 3 hours and just talked. And that was our treat. And that's the sort of love that these teachers had in those days. They were really kind. They were really special. You learnt a lot. And it was just like being in a big family, and they were really pleasant days. And I still talk to two or three who are still in that age group in that era, and which is really, really good.
I feel sorry for, I got little kids, one just started high school, two still at primary school, and they have very flash facilities.
Yes.
But I feel sorry for them that they don't have the teaching that we had.
Correct.
Because we had a teaching that built your character.
Yes, yes.
And you look back and you realise many of your teachers were veterans of World War II.
World War II.
And they were different.
They were.
And we had, of course, at primary school even, half the teachers were male.
Yes.
No.
Well, one of my teachers at Southland Boys High School was a gentleman by the name of Jack Alabaster. Now, Jack and Green Alabaster were New Zealand cricketers. And I believe Jack Alabaster may still be alive. If he is, he'd be in his late 90s. I think he lives in Queenstown or Central Otago. He may even be listening to the program. But he was a great disciplinarian. He never caned anybody, but everybody never turned up late to his class because apparently he wasn't allowed to cane with his right hand because his right hand being a spin bowler, he had this little wee flick. And the rumour that was going out was that if Jack Alabaster caned with his right hand, he would draw blood. So nobody was willing to put it to the test. But those sort of people were amazing. And Green Alabaster, his brother, was a terrific teacher. He taught me for gymnastics, or not gymnastics, for gym. He was a gym teacher, and Jack was a maths teacher. And those sort of people were really, really special. Doug McClyman, another one, were really, really special because they were good disciplinarians. You knew the boundaries. You always called them sir. You always did as you were told. You always turned up on time. You never, ever, ever disrespected them in any way because you knew what consequences, but they had that discipline without, you know, whacking you to death sort of thing.
Yeah. And you didn't run home to mum or dad and complain about you were treated unfairly at school, because if you did, you'd get another whack.
Yes, that's right.
The parents supported
the scrap at the end of the table.
Yes. The parents supported the teachers 100%.
Totally. Totally.
They say that Invercargill and New Zealand was a little boring in the 60s. Mick Jagger didn't think much of Invercargill when they toured New Zealand.
Yes, I heard
Rolling Stones.
Mm.
How did you find it?
I felt it was really quite interesting as far as high school days, but during my former days, I was quite lonely. I had two older brothers. My older brother was working. My other brother had left, had gone to university at Otago, then went to Auckland. He was an astrophysicist and got double PhD with first class honours. So
Jeepers.
He was in a different level than me.
He got the brains in the family.
Yeah, I think so.
PhD in those days.
Sorry?
A double PhD.
Yeah, yeah. He actually went on to do very, very well and was, in fact, one of the lead people in the Space Hubble telescope. And he developed a team to actually do the telescope. One of the things he did as a child, about a 10-year-old, was to actually grind his own mirror for his telescope. He actually made a telescope. It was a big tube about, I don't know, 2 or 3 meters long. And he actually had this mirror that he ground down with katarumdum powder. And he did it all by hand. He had a piece of Meccano and a torch to get the light reflection to make sure
it was.
And anyway, they got it tested and they sent it over to Australia to test this lens. And they said, who did this for you? And he said, I did it. He said, well, it's so perfect that it looks as though it's been done by machine.
He was 10 or 11.
He made, I think it was a 12-inch telescope. So the mirror diameter was 12 inches.
Wow.
It was not just a small telescope, it was quite big.
And so you've got to get a perfect parabola.
You do.
On that mirror.
Yes.
And in the early days when they were making them, I read about this in a book, like they were getting ground in France and shipped out to America. You couldn't get them done in America in the 1900s. You had to, that's beyond anything, making those mirrors.
Oh, yeah. It was incredible. And he did it by himself in this little shed down the back of our property in Invercargill. And he went on to do what he did. He went to South Africa and then he went to Chile. And he became the director of the big observatory in Santiago. So, it's quite an amazing story.
So he's a child prodigy.
Yeah, you could say that. At the time, he was my big brother and my dad and him would go outside at night and look at the stars. And
well, I suppose your dad being a watchmaker too, he got that instrument manufacturing that precision.
Yes. Oh, it took him hours and hours and hours, and all he could hear was this grinding noise. And, of course, I would want to go and see what he's doing. And he said, no, you're not coming in here because it was all in darkness. It was all done in darkness. So I didn't see a lot of the grinding work, but I know how long it took him to do it.
Is he still alive?
Yes, he's living with his wife and family. They're over in La Serena, which is in Chile. Went to see him in 2005. Don't see a lot of him, but he's still alive and well over there.
How wonderful. What a wonder. Yeah. Did you know Bert Munro?
That's a very, very interesting story. My mother and her brother, my uncle who is deceased, were very, very, very good friends of Bert Munro. And she often told me that, and had photographs of being on the back of Bert Munro's motorbikes. They went everywhere together. Bert Munro went down to Bluff or to Arua one day and he got a puncture. So they're well away from everywhere. Of course, they didn't have phones or anything like this. So what he did was he cut some flax and took the inner tube out and stuffed the flax in the area so he could actually get them both home. So that's how he did. Another time he had a little batch or something down in Arua Bay and he forgot the key, so he had to get down the chimney and got himself stuck. So it was that's amazing stories from that vintage. And Mum would have loved to have seen the Indian, you know, the film, but of course it was much later and than when she was alive. So but
it was a lovely, lovely, lovely movie, wasn't it?
It was a lovely movie. It was an incredible movie.
Mm. Very moving.
Yeah.
Very, very moving.
And well played too.
Oh, Anthony Hopkins is just a master.
Yes.
Did people who knew him or from Invercargill, did they feel it was a fair depiction?
I knew his son, John, who lived in Oamaru, actually, in Herbert. And I think it was pretty fair. A lot of people ridiculed him, from what I can believe. Yes. A lot of people thought he was a nutter.
Well, you would. I think it's a bit like a 10-year-old grinding away on a piece of glass. I mean, if my 10-year-old was doing that, I'd say, come on, come and do the dishes, do something useful.
Yeah,
you can't imagine them helping build the Hubble telescope and working it later in life. And a guy with a clapped-out old motorbike.
Doing about 280 kilometres an hour or whatever it was. Yes. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And be the fastest man in the world and the oldest motorbike.
Yes.
And he just kept at it.
And that record still stands today.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, which is incredible. But I think the thing about Invercargill, there are a lot of very understated people there, a lot of people who flew under the radar.
Yes.
And there were some really, really interesting people. I know that Sir Garfield Todd was an old boy of South Boys High School.
Yes.
So there are a lot of people there that went on and did wonderful things. Graham Allbell.
Yes.
Geoffrey Allbell? Graham Allbell, he discovered the Natornis, the bird in Fiordland.
The Takahe in 1948.
A lot of interesting people there.
And it's a beautiful landscape.
It is. It's fabulous down there. It really is.
Absolutely fabulous. There's so much beauty in Southland. And the people are like people used to be in New Zealand, it seems to me.
That's absolutely right.
And they're honest, hardworking, very generous. And I went down there to Dyack's Nursery. I'll give them big plug. That's about in the fourth generation.
Yes.
And I went down there and bought a whole trailer full of things. And the guy just said to me, oh, well, you know, you're coming back, fix me up tomorrow.
Yes.
And I thought, can you imagine saying that in Auckland?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Now, well, one of the Dyacks went to the same church as me. And he was a great, I think he was an elder in the church, and he was just a really, really nice man. And
but listeners, this is the nursery in Invercargill that's sort of been run there since 1902.
Yes.
And something like that. And it's like in the fourth generation's hands now.
Yes.
And you feel as though you're always going to get looked after when it's a fourth generation business in New Zealand.
You're absolutely right.
And I remember speaking to the young man who was a Dyack, and I said to him, oh, have you been here long? And without, I'm pretty sure I've got this right. I might have the dates wrong. But I just about fell over. So, oh, no, not long here. We started out over somewhere else. He said, we've only been here since 1952.
Wow, 1952. That's amazing. And they've got this big, huge macrocarpa hedge that goes right around it. I don't know. It's huge. And I suppose a year or so ago, I went down there and went up Inglewood Road and round the corner into Tweed Street. And there it is. It's still there. I mean, nothing's changed.
And they live, his mum and dad lived next door on one side of the nursery, and he lived across the road.
Across the road, yeah. Wow.
It's just wonderful. When you're dealing with people like that, you feel community that you don't feel nowadays.
No.
What was your first job?
My first job was at Dalgety New Zealand Loan Limited, Dalgety New Zealand Loan. And I was office junior, straight from school. started off in 3 months in each of their departments, or four departments. I was in accounts for 3 months, and then they put me into stock department for 3 months. They put me into merchandise for 3 months, and that involved really dusting all the shelves in the shop downstairs in Spay Street, and just running messages and buying tartan paint and all that sort of stuff, because everybody had me on about, you know, as office junior, they
took the mickey out of me. Yeah,
that's it. And then I had a time out at the wool store out at Lawnville, the big Dalgety wool store that was out at near Lawnville. But I told them from day one that I always wanted to be into travel. Want to get into the travel department. They said, well, every man and his dog wants to get into travel, because they seem to travel everywhere all the time overseas on these educational trips. So don't expect to be in travel, for the foreseeable future.
And Dalgety's was, I always think of Dalgety's as sort of like a stock agent, but it was more
than
that.
They were a stock agency. Yeah, they were. They were basically a stock company. So after...
And they took you on... You were like a cadet or an apprentice in a way to the business. And the expectation was they'll shuffle you around, you'll get to know how Dalgety's. What a great education that would have been.
Well, it was. And each department, I'm saying this in modesty, each department said, oh, we want to keep Lindsay on. They said, no, he's going to go to another one. So I went, as I say, from stock to merchandise to accounts to everybody else. And everybody wanted to sort of hold me. And anyway, I was in about 2 weeks into the wool department out at Lawnville, and I got a call one day, and the big boss said, I want to see you in my office. And I thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? Because nobody speaks to Mark Anderson, who is the manager of the branch. Nobody ever talks to him, because he's right up there, higher than everybody else.
Yeah.
So he said, get hold of a car and bring it up into the Spay Street car park, which was on the first level of the building, and I'll see you in 20 minutes. So I thought, oh my gosh. So I borrowed a car. I'd only just got my license, borrowed the wall manager's car, which was a Zodiac, and went into Dalgety's very, very carefully. And the only space in this car park, we had to go up a big ramp on the first level. And the only car space was beside Mark Anderson's car, which was a brand new Chrysler Hemi.
And very
smart car. And I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do here? So anyway, I parked it and turned it off, made sure the handbrake was on and all the rest of it, and walked into his office. And there would be about eight or so other people in his office. And I thought, what is going on here? And it was all the departmental heads of each department, the grain department, the merchandise department, the accounts, the accountant was there, and all these other ones were there, and they must have been having a meeting. And I was almost terrified. My knees were knocking. I must have been an absolute mess going down. They said, sit down. So I sat down.
How old were you?
And I was only 18, just turned 18, or just on 18. And they said, we want you to be in travel. We want you to go into travel. Are you still wanting to be in the travel department? I said, oh, yes, please. I really want to be in travel. So he said, there's a vacancy, and the only thing is you've got to keep going out at the wool department for another 3 or 4 weeks or 4 weeks before you go into travel full time. So I put up with being in travel and wool. Nothing really went into my head. I was thinking about travel and all the rest of it. And I ended up in travel. And within a year and a little bit, I was made travel manager. And at that time, I was the youngest departmental head in New Zealand. And I was the youngest travel manager within the company. So it was a fairly meteoric rise from this little schoolboy who left South Boys High School and ended up in travel.
What was it you think about you as a young boy? And we don't need to be modest, because we're both old men looking back. But it's so interesting, isn't it? What was it about you that these departments singled you out and you were picked out? What was it? Was it brains? Was it willingness to work? Was it hard work? Was it politeness? Was it doing what you're asked? Was it being clever? and able to problem solve. What was it about you that you felt that picked you out back then?
I think it was an ability to get on with people. Yes. But also I think going the extra mile made a big difference. I had a standard that I think was input into me from my parents to do your very, very best at all times and go beyond the call of duty. And I always want to be punctual. I've always been punctual in my life, and I just wanted to make sure that I was there and doing the very, very best I could. And if it meant staying on an extra half an hour, it didn't matter. I would do that. If it meant cleaning up somebody's mess, I would do it. If it meant cleaning the toilets, I'd do it. So
don't you wish that you could have a young person listen to you and me?
It would be very 16, interesting.
Because they don't realize, and nor did you or I realize, that the big bosses are always on the lookout for good workers.
Yes.
And they'll hold a good worker, they'll promote a good worker, and it's actually the most basic of things that you need to do.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't do it for self-fulfillment. I did it because I thought that's what was expected of me.
Absolutely. Tell me, you mentioned church. What church did you go to?
Well, I started off at the Northern Bacargo Baptist Church.
Yes.
And I went for a time to the Central Baptist Church.
Yes.
And also the Glengarry Baptist Church. So basically there were three major churches, and we sort of rotated around. The youth group was quite good in all of them. The one that the Central Baptist was the biggest church, and there was a very good pastor there, the Reverend Browning, who became, I think he was the chairman of the New Zealand Tennis Association. And he was very high up in tennis, and a really nice character as well. So there were some very good ministers, and I really enjoyed my time with the Baptist Church.
Are you still a Baptist?
Yes, we go to the Timaru Bible Baptist Church, which is a very small church. It's a family church in Timaru. We live in Temuka, which is about 20 kilometres away, and that's where we retired to.
What do Baptists believe that separates them from Presbyterians and Methodists?
That's a very, very good question. I know for where we are, we believe the Bible is the truth, and it's very Bible orientated.
So you're fundamental?
Yes.
Great. Because I think if you're going to be a Christian, the Bible's true.
It's very, very true. And as you get older, and you basically do research, a lot of the charismatic churches, not, I suppose you've got to be really careful what I say here, but a lot of them tend to not to see the significance of the Old Testament.
Yes.
But the Old Testament and the New Testament are very, very interlocked. If you're reading parts of the Old Testament, it does have relevance in the New Testament. And the further and deeper you read it, you understand a lot of what's going on. And you can see a lot of the things that are happening in the world today are basically a prophecy from Old Testament times and been prophesied.
Yes. So a Baptist church wouldn't go along with gay marriage and stuff like that?
I think some do. I would think some hold a very firm line of it. Some are more liberal. But we read the King James from the King James version. Some, of course, don't do that. But I suppose it just depends on the individual minister. But, the good thing about it is that we go there to learn, and it's good fellowship, but it's also to learn the truth from the Bible, and we've got a very good pastor that does that.
I must say I've started reading the Bible, and I was given by a listener the Bible Believer's Companion, which is a huge book. And even huger, if there's such a word, because it's very thin, tissuey paper. And I read that. Do you know? It's the best thing I do all day.
That's great.
And I had no idea how great Bible study is. It's so interesting. I can just open. I've always tried to read the Bible by starting at the start, but that's so tough. Yes. So now I just literally think of a story that I remember from Sunday school when I was 6 and 7 and 8, and I pick it up and I just read a little bit, then I read the companion, and then it goes me off, and then I'll be Googling it and reading about it. And you can see why studying the Bible is in of itself an education.
Yes, yes, it is. The thing that's really, really good too, and you've got resources now, you can go onto Google and find different things, and some, of course, you've got to be very careful with, but there are people, there's one pastor that's really interesting from overseas, Alan Nolan, and, you know, he talks about what happens when you die. Where do you go? Do your family who have passed on, can they see you or can they hear you or whatever, what happens here, what happens there? And things like this, which is really, really, really interesting. Billy Crone is another one that basically goes through all biblically based, Bible-based, not wishy-washy stuff.
No.
And another one that we're doing a lot of study on with Israel, of course, is Amir Safati, and that's on the Telegram. And you can go onto that and you can actually learn what is actually happening in real time in Israel. And there's a lot of stuff that we are told, which is absolutely kibosh, you know, that you read in the newspapers or you see on television or see whatever. It doesn't give you the whole story. But from an Israeli actually sitting in the middle of the war zone, it is fascinating, really, really fascinating.
I must look that up. I might have to go to you to get those references. Thank you so much. So, Del Geddes, you went into travel then.
Yes.
How did that go?
It went really well. I think there was a fear in me because I often would have wild dreams at night, whether when I wrote out Mrs. Jones's tickets or Mrs. Thomas's tickets, whether I crossed the T and dotted the I, and did I put the right
didn't
fear
get stuck
on
in Beirut or something.
So that being so young, and of course I had to learn a lot. But the interesting thing after that, what came of it, was I was transferred to London. I was seconded to London, and that was something that was really, really sought after. But I was really nonplussed because I was doing quite well in athletics at the time, and I didn't really want to leave. And I was thinking, well, why would I want to go to London from Invercargill? Invercargill's got it all. What's the point of going to London? But
that sounds pretty funny, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm in Chicago. Why would I go to London?
Everybody was breaking an arm and a leg to get to London. There was only one secondment every 3 or so years. And here was I given the opportunity, and here was I saying, I don't really want to go. Why do I have to go? I'm quite happy. So anyway, I went screaming to London. And the first
what
thing
year?
They
did, what yep. year did you go to London?
That was, when was that? 1969, I suppose it was, 1970.
Would that have been something?
Yeah, and anyway, the first thing they did, one of the girls gave me a haircut, which she said, you can't have an Invercargill haircut, you've got to have a London haircut. So that was the first thing they did to me. And they sent me off to get some London clothes. So I looked, you know, very, very impressed. The first place I went to was called High and Mighty. And I thought, you know, being 6'6" or 6'5", 197 centimetres tall, that would be the sort of place to go to. And I was told that I was too small. Having gone to the High and Mighty shop, they said, no, we start at size 17 shoes, and we do 5Xs to start off with. And I said, well, where do you go? And they said, well, you can't normally, you're sort of in between the Marks and Spencers and all these other shops and this High and Mighty shop. So, but eventually I found some clothes, so I didn't go naked to work. And it was really good. It was interesting. Dealt with some fascinating people, some lords and ladies, and you know, high people. A lot of New Zealanders coming over on travel, which we saw a lot of Kiwis. I saw more Kiwis that I knew walking down the main street of London than I did in other places in New Zealand. It was extraordinary that all of a sudden you'd see your next door neighbour walking down the street, and you think, "What are you doing here? This is London."
Isn't that something?
So So it was great. And at the end of 3 years I was over there, I didn't really want to come home. But they wanted me back in New Zealand, so I had to come back.
And this was Dalgetty's?
It was Dalgetty's.
And Dalgetty's had an actual office in London?
Yes, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
It was Conduit Street, which was just off Regent Street, and down was New Bond Street. So it was.
You must have thought you were £1 million living in London, working.
Well, yes and no. A lot of my mum used to say, "Did you see this in London?" I said, "No, mum, I was too busy working." Have you been able to see this, or did you see that? I said, "Well, I go to work in the morning. It takes me 45 minutes to go about 4 or 5 miles." And even longer at night and even longer in the summer. So I didn't see a lot of London except in the weekends. And some of the weekends I'd go out in the countryside, and I bought a car, which was really, really nice. I brought it back to New Zealand with me. It was a Daimler Sovereign.
Wow.
And it was a really flash car.
4.2 litre?
Yep, it was 4.2 litre.
So that was a V8?
No, it wasn't. I think it was a V6. Straight six. Yeah, it was a straight six.
Beautiful car.
Yeah, it was. It was owned by the Leyland's general manager, so it was well looked after. Mm. But just after I bought it, I missed out on buying the Queen Mother's car. She had one in the Royal Fleet, and it had the little wee Royal Standard on the front and the whole nine yards. And it was on the same price, so I felt a little bit cheated that I hadn't waited another couple of weeks.
But
it was nice. So I sold the car when I got back to buy a house, put the deposit on the house. So that was the end of the Daimler. But it was a beautiful car. And
and you'd make a lot of money bringing it back to New Zealand in those days, did you?
Yeah, in those days. There was a lot of, people bring them back at those days.
And you'd lived overseas long enough that you didn't have to pay duties on it.
That's right. Exactly.
Back in New Zealand?
Yes.
You said that you were keen on athletics. What athletics were you doing?
I was basically an all-rounder, although my two main events were shot and discus. I enjoyed shot and discus at high school, and then I went on and went to St. Paul's Harrier, an amateur athletic club, and did quite well there. And, I was also a sprinter. I didn't do any training for sprinting, but I really upset some people one year when I decided to do some sprint starts and enter myself in the Southland Champs and won it, which really hacked a lot of people off because they did a lot of training for it. So I was reasonably fast for my size. Somebody said that the whole ground shook when I rang, which is probably right. But discus and shot I really enjoyed.
And did you compete throughout New Zealand or just in Southland?
No, I competed in the New Zealand Championships. But at those days, there were two very fine athletes, and one was Les Mills, and the other was Robin Tate.
Yes.
And Robin Tate was the discus Commonwealth champion, and Les Mills was the shot put champion as well. And Walter Gill was there. He was Jack O'Gill's father. He was competing. Compete against Arthur Ruffle and other ones like that. There were some very, very good shot and discus throwers around that time.
And they were training seriously.
Oh, they're the real deal. Here's me from Invercargill. But I did enjoy it. I think I was rated about sixth in New Zealand at the time. So it was okay. But if I'd stayed on, my intention when I got to London was, of course, to go, and Jeff Capes was the British and Commonwealth champion, who was a really, really good English shot putter. And my idea was to go to Crystal Palace because it was only a matter of about 5 or 10 kilometres away and train at nights. But the problem was you're working very, very hard in the summer because it's high season, and I wouldn't be getting home till 8, 9 o'clock at night. And, of course, you weren't feeling like doing a couple of hours of training at night after
that. And also getting around London isn't like driving across Invercargill.
No, it was hugely problematical.
Mm. Back in New Zealand?
Yes.
What'd you do?
Well, I was seconded to Oamaru, and I worked for Dalgetty's. for a time in their travel department in Oamaru. Then I was
I like Oamaru,
yeah,
but it's not London.
No.
Did you feel it a bit small?
It was for a start. Mm. Yeah, it was for a start. I felt a little bit like a fish out of water, but I had a purpose, and the purpose was to get accreditation for that particular travel agency, which we did. But after doing so, I was headhunted to go to Auckland, and I went to Auckland. And long story short, I set up a company to represent Greyhound Coachlines, which is America and the world's largest coach company. So they needed representation in New Zealand, as did Greyhound Australia, Greyhound Canada, and also another company called Brewster's, which is a coach line in Canada. So we set up a company, and I was the general manager or the CEO, whatever you like to call myself. And I also went around all the travel agencies in New Zealand to basically tell them all about Greyhound and give them all the supplies and brochures and did the whole marketing of it in New Zealand for Greyhound. And that was a huge job because I do 60,000 to 70,000 Ks a year of traveling. We'd go to Australia to see Greyhound Australia, go to the United States, go to Canada. So it took a lot of time.
Was it a wrench leaving Dalgety?
It was to a large extent because they were very, very good to me. Mm. And I felt as though having achieved what I could for Dalgety, that was as far as I could go. I was like probably like a bigger goldfish in a very, very small tank. I need to go out and do other things.
Did you get married?
Yes, I was married at the time, took our family up to Auckland, and there was a lot of pressure on because, of course, living in Glenfield, it was miles away from where my office was, and doing all that travelling was really, really tough. My then wife was, it was very, very hard on her. And we eventually came back to Oamaru, mainly because of the commuting and all the time away from home and all the rest of it.
And so that was like a marriage decision to get back to Oamaru for your wife's sake?
Yes.
And what did you do then back in Oamaru?
Well, again, I was headhunted and set up a house of travel.
Why? No one's ever hunted my head. How does headhunting work? Someone says, I want a person to do X in New Zealand, and they go looking, and they say, I want you.
Well, I don't know whether it's the size of my head or because my head was that much ahead, above the rest of the crowd, but as I said, I'm reasonably tall, so perhaps the arrow stuck.
Yeah. Just out there, anyone, I'm happy to be headhunted for something, anything. So you were headhunted then to do what?
Well, to set up a travel agency in Oamaru, and we bought the old Union Steamship Agency, and that was the Union Company, which inherited or had the Air New Zealand contract for the airport operation, and we operated F-27 Fokker Friendships at that time.
Yes.
And we had a service left in the morning at 7:15 and came in again at about 5:30 at night. We basically operated that 7 days a week, and there was a lot of stories about different funny things that happened.
Where was the flight going to from Oamaru?
It went Oamaru via Timaru and then Timaru to Wellington. So when it left, it had 48 seats. The Series 1 had 40 seats and the larger one had 48 seats. So we would fill up probably 12 or 15 seats maybe, and then the rest were filled up out of Timaru. So by the time it left Timaru, it was relatively full, and then it went to Wellington. The good thing about it, it got to Wellington about 9 o'clock in the morning, 9:15. People could do a whole day's work in Wellington, and then they could leave at 5 o'clock and get back just after whatever time it was at night.
And remember that old Wellington airport back in the day?
Yes.
It was an old Air Force hangar, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And you would have had the local MP hopping on that plane to go to Wellington, I imagine.
Yes, yes. Also, Campbell Park was going at that stage too, so there were quite a few children from Campbell Park School. That was the big estate, Apakura, or Otakaiki, And yep. So there are a lot of people going from there. We also had a lot of cargo went out of Oamaru. We had Gillies Foundry. They made lots of irrigation pipes and different things, valves and type of things. We also had leather that went out. We also had things like tulips that we were going to Japan, that they'd leave in the morning from Oamaru and they'd be in Japan that night. So they'd fly out all the way to Japan.
And what's the funniest story you've got?
Yeah, there are quite a few. I think when Air New Zealand had finished their operation, they took the F-27s off and they then downgrade and downsize. And I think the funniest thing was a guy was late for the aircraft, and so he decided to try to cut it off when it was actually trying to take off, which was not a great idea. So he was arrested. We had one lady who came out with three dogs, and she wanted to get them on board the aircraft, and they said, well, they're not sedated, and they're not in crates, and we haven't done the all the procedures for that. And of course, you had to be very careful with weights, because we had people getting on in Timaru and we had to have the whole plane yeah. balanced and the cargo, you know, we couldn't actually have an aircraft crashing at the end of the runway because of her three dogs. So she got really, 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 really upset. So there are things like that. There are a number of incidents that happened that weren't so funny at the time, but looking back, they're quite yes. amusing.
Yes. And more things happened to you.
Yes.
You then went on to?
Well, then again, without using the word headhunted, I was approached to go to Papua New Guinea. And I was to look after.
Well, headhunted has a particular significance, I would imagine. In Papua New Guinea.
Yes, more ways than one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I went to Papua New Guinea. And Papua New Guinea was right off the scale as far as opportunity, but also probably a little bit scary because I had no idea what was going to happen. And it was during the Asian crisis, the currency crisis and the economic downturn, and things were pretty hairy over there. We had the rascals from the highlands would come down and they would cause havoc. They did all sorts of deeds which were not very good. We had a high security situation. We had two dogs, for example. One was called Mike Tyson and one was called Brutus, and they're the most evil-looking dogs and the most dangerous dogs I've ever seen in my life, and they were there to protect us. And we had some incidents where people tried to rob us because we had a lot of cash on site. It was like the Wild West without the horses. It was really, really quite wild in those days.
And you're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hunt. I'm talking to Lindsay Walker, who we've got on to talk about orphanages, and we've got sidetracked talking about his wonderful life. What were you doing in Papua New Guinea, for goodness sake?
Well, I was offered $1 million, which in those days was a lot of money, if I could stick it out for 3 years.
That's a lot of money. What year was this?
That was 1995.
$1 million. And what did you? What were you doing there for $1 million?
Well, I had to look after or oversee the operation. It was an operation including a big supermarket type warehouse. They had a supermarket which was like it's not like supermarkets here. It was like a third world supermarket. It was on about three different levels, and they supplied sort of like a wholesaler to lots of little wee smaller roadside supermarkets. We sold huge amounts of cigarettes and things like that. And it was just basically a trading company. So there was that, and we also had a secondhand car sales. We also had a new car sales. We also had a shipping company, and we also had a travel agency. And my role was to be able to go and make sure everything was kosher. And when I arrived there, we found that there was a huge number of people who owed the company money. They weren't paying. So one of my tasks was being debt collector. And because of my size and deep field voice, I don't know whether that paid anything towards it, but I was asked to go and get some of this money back. And I always remember one day went into this big, huge Stockade, and this company owed us about $105,000 Australian dollars. So it was quite a substantial amount of money. And I asked where the boss was, and they said, "Oh, no, boss not here." But I knew the boss was there because I saw the curtains on the second floor were moving, and I thought, well, that's probably where the boss is. So I said to my staff, who arrived in three different cars, "Let's go and take some of these cars that they've got, because we'll hold them until we get the money, or we'll sell the cars." So we took these cars, and just as we're getting out to the barricade, which they had the big stockade, I had a loaded shotgun in the back. I had an AK and I had a Glock pistol with 7 or 8 bullets in my belt. So I thought I was pretty well armed, but they pulled an AK-47 on me.
There's always the guy with the bigger gun.
Yeah, and they shut the gate at the same time. So we had to give the cars back. And just as I was heading off, all the guys went off home. I took one of these cars back, our own car back. And I was doing a U-turn on a motorway, and all of a sudden I could legally do this U-turn on this motorway, and I had to cross three lanes of traffic on my side to get on the other side. And anyway, I got halfway across and the transmission seized on my car. And here was I sitting in the fast lane of this motorway, looked out and I saw this bus coming at me, and they weren't going to stop. They saw a white man, the only car that I had that could stand being hit by a bus was a Mercedes 280 SE. You know those big square boxes?
Yeah, I know them.
And it had side impact beams and all the rest, blah, blah, blah.
Be a W124 probably, was it?
Yeah, I think so. And anyway, I was parked in the middle of the motorway. I couldn't get out. By the time I got out, and of course it had a transmission hump in the middle, you just couldn't take your seatbelt off and jump in the other seat, because it was just impossible. And I only had 3 seconds anyway before this thing was going to hit me. And the only thing I could do was pray. And I said, "Lord, help me. Jesus, save me." That's all I could say. And the next second, I got hit by this bus doing 70 Ks. And they reckon from evidence that the guy put his foot down, because they thought, white man in Mercedes must have lots of money. We need a new bus. So they hit me at 70 to 80 Ks an hour on my right-hand door, moved the car, they reckon, about 80 to 90 feet, dropped the suspension, punctured the tires, and absolutely destroyed my car and destroyed their bus. They reckon the block on the motor block went back half an inch to an inch. That's what the impact of this smash did to my car and to him. Now, over there, they have what they call payback, and they have tit for tat. This is where tit for tat comes from. You do something to them, they'll come back and do something to you. And so if I had killed anybody, they would have killed me just like that. Even though I had a loaded Glock, they probably would have used it. If I killed two people, they would kill me, and they'll kill somebody else back at the office. If they killed half a dozen people, they'd just go around until they had actually got revenge. An eye for an eye. This is where an eye for an eye comes from. Fortunately, nobody was killed. I was pretty badly beaten up. And these guys, instead of helping me out, decided to take and dismantle the stereo system on this Mercedes, because it was quite a nice stereo system. So they took the stereo out. There was oil and water and everything else pouring around all around the place. And eventually they got me out and they took me to hospital and they patched me up. And, yeah, I survived. But I think I'm the only person that's ever ridden off a bus with a car, even though it was a Mercedes 280 SE.
And it T-boned you?
Yes, totally T-boned me.
That's great advertising for a Mercedes.
Well, I wrote to Mercedes and said, hey, if ever you want me to endorse your product, I'd love to be able to do it. Yeah. I'm very open for a free sample to be able to help you with it.
I had for many years a V8, the W126, the next model probably after yours.
Right.
And I only just sold it last year. Oh, I loved that car.
Yes.
And you felt very safe in it. What were your injuries?
Well, the thing was, I had a lot of glass fragments, particularly in my face, and they went along and they basically took out the glass fragments, supposedly. And I said to them after they stitched me all up, I said, I can still feel glass in my face. And I said, you have taken the glass out. And they said, no, boss. So what they had to do was they had to pull all the stitches out and restitch it without anesthetic. And I tell you what, when you see these guys, getting stitched up at halftime in the rugby.
Cowboy movie, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like that in real life. So they did 21 stitches and then they had to take them all out and restitch it. But the amazing thing about, and I thank God for that, and the fact that apart from a very, very small scar over the top of one of my eyes, which you can't really see, an injury to one of my thumbs, which I had to come back to New Zealand to get proper work done on it. I got out scot free, but it could have been a whole lot worse. Could have been.
Did you have your family there?
No, it was just me. My marriage, my first marriage, fell over, and we were separated. So this was probably a reason for me to actually try to start a new life. And
yeah.
I had good relationship with my children and they were obviously sorry to see me go, but they knew that this was a good start for me and come back after 2 or 3 years and be more financially secure.
Pretty funny, Dad, with a Glock pistol stuck down his belt.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was.
You reckon you could have used it?
I had the opportunity only once, and that's another story if I've got a minute to tell you. The Chinese owned this big, huge trading company, and they moved hundreds of tons of product around, like bags of sugar, bags of flour, bags of this, bags of that, and all the rest of it. And anyway, they didn't throw anything out. They had a lot of food that they would actually just sell, regardless of being past its expiry date or contaminated with whatever. And so anyway, they went off to, I think they went off to Singapore for the weekend. So I decided to have a clean out. So we had a huge Big Mac truck and a trailer. So truck and trailer were probably 10 ton for the truck and 5 ton for the trailer. So we filled it up with all the old food. And I was going to take it to the local dump in the jungle to get it all buried because it was, like I say, it was not really fit for habitation. So I got one of my staff, and of course, I didn't realize that the Bush Telegraph works very well over there. And everybody in the outskirts of Port Moresby, Bardeli, knew that there was going to be a consignment of food, even though it was contaminated, was going to be dumped. So they had a welcome room squad ready for us. So we loaded all this food in, going down the road at 60-odd k's an hour, with all the jungle all around us. It was a gravel road heading along the road at a great rate of knots. And all of a sudden, way up ahead, we could see these 44-gallon drums being put across the road. And we could see that I could see that they are armed as well. So I said to my driver, who was one of my staff, we stop. He said, no, boss, we don't stop. He said, we stop. I said, no, we carry on. We're not going to stop for these guys because they'll probably take our truck. They'll take me, whatever. We're not going to stop. So he put his foot on the brake and I reached over and put my big size 14 shoes on the accelerator. And between the two of them, we went through this, roadblock at about 60 so Ks an hour with this 15 ton truck and trailer unit on. They were shooting wildly at us. Bullets were going everywhere. I actually told him, if he stops, he dies. So I put the Glock up to his forehead.
Wow!
And told my staff member that if he stops, he dies. He doesn't take. He lets this has got to go through. So the truck roared through. My foot was bigger than his foot, obviously, And we went through this roadblock and there were bullets everywhere flying around. Got to the place where we had to bury it all. And I was standing on the back of the truck doing my United Nations health and safety talk. You know, you don't take this food because it's contaminated and you get hepatitis A and B and C and all the rest of it. And all these probably 300 or 400 locals were all around the truck. And I was very nicely shepherded off the truck, standing on the back of it, saying, "We're going to bury it." And they were saying, we want to take it. So in the end, they took it. And I would estimate that within 3.5 minutes, that truck and trailer were completely stripped of food and they were gone. They were vanished into the jungle. We didn't see them again. On our way home, we never saw the people who put the drums across the road. We got back and that was the end of that. But that was the only time I used my Glock. And fortunately,
how was your staff member after that?
He was okay. He said it was probably not a good idea to stop. I said, no, it wasn't a good idea to stop.
But it's probably not in the Dalgetty office manual that that's how you persuade someone to your call to action. You put a Glock.
I don't know where it just came to me. I don't know.
Isn't
where
that
it got
amazing?
It was nothing ever happened in
you
my
were
life.
Like, you were like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something else. That is really something else.
Yeah. It's never happened to me since, thank goodness.
Do you think you would have pulled it?
No.
No.
But I know that one of our bosses, one of the directors, had a rental car in the Highlands, and he was completely stripped down to his underpants. They took all his money, they took his gun, they took his passports, they took everything. And these guys, if they see an opportunity, they'll take it. And you don't know what's going to happen. It was.
Did you get your $1 million?
No. After my accident, I had to come home. I was only over there for 4.5 months.
Gee,
and then I got malaria. That was the other thing. I got malaria very badly. And I think the malaria was actually worse than the actual road accident. As hard as that is to imagine, because I was pretty sore and pretty hurt. But malaria was tough. And if I didn't, the Chinese gave me a whole lot of little pills to take. And I don't know what they were in these pills, but I took them for 6 days. I drank a liter of water an hour. And they said, if you don't drink this water every hour on the hour, you're going to die. So I had to drink a liter of water every hour on the hour for about 3 days. Hardly ever went to the toilet because it was so hot. Amazing.
What an experience.
Yeah.
Wow, I just by the way, did you get any training in how to shoot a pistol?
No. But I got a license to operate an AK-47 because we basically got one. The one was on order. It didn't arrive before I arrived, thank goodness. But I went down to the police station and they looked at my driver's license and my passport, and they gave me a license that I could use anything, including an AK-47, which is really, really scary because I had no training and I had no desire to use an AK-47 because right beside the trading company where I worked, there was a school with about 300 or 400 kids in it. And I tell you what, if bullets were flying and if anybody tried to rob this place, I think the owners of this trading company would probably have no hesitation to use it. They wanted me to look at putting elephant wiring around the perimeter to keep people away, which would have, you know, little kids dig underground to get the Coke cans and the bottles that were sitting outside in the sun. It was pretty crude, pretty bad. There were lots of dramas over there, lots of stories, lots of things happened. Unbelievable things.
I'm still annoyed about the $1 million.
Yes.
I'm upset.
I didn't come out with anything.
I thought it was like a happy ending and I came home with $1 million. Wow.
It would have been nice.
And what did you do upon arriving home? No marriage?
No.
No $1 million?
No.
And malaria?
Yeah. Well, then I applied for a position with the Waitaki District Council as tourism manager.
Mm.
And I got it. And wow. I was very, very grateful for that. So, yeah.
Now, orphanages.
Yes.
Well, did it come about?
One, it all started with a little boy called Daniel, and Daniel lived in Rwanda. And I went to a meeting one night with Tearfund. They came down from Auckland and they had all these little wee profiles of children. And I saw Daniel and I thought I'd like to sponsor Daniel. This was the time I was single and by myself. And so I sponsored Daniel. And long story short, Daniel's father was in the genocide in Rwanda. He was from Rwanda. He was tied up with the Tutsis versus the Hutus. There was a civil war, as you probably know, and a lot of people died, and he was a part of it. So he's in jail. He's been in jail ever since. So Daniel was left without a father. His mother was a peasant farm worker. So there was a situation where Daniel really needed support. So for $1 a day, I supported Daniel, wrote to him often. He didn't know English, so it had to be translated, but he was very diligent and wrote to me quite often. So Daniel and I had a really, really good relationship. And then I married Delaine. Delaine married just on 21 years ago. So when Delaine married me, she said, well, you've got a wee boy in Rwanda. I'd like a little girl. So again, we went to a Tearfund meeting, and there was a little girl called Harriet. And Harriet lives in Uganda, just across the border. So she had a wee girl and I had a wee boy. Not that it made any difference. But long story is that Daniel is now 26 or thereabouts. He's happily married. He's got two little children. He built his own house. He's got his own little business as well. And this little boy who was going to be basically probably in the fields as a labourer, all of a sudden has got an amazing life. And we still speak to each other quite regularly. Very, very good situation with Daniel and Harriet. She was what started this whole situation with our outreach in Uganda.
So for $1 a day?
Yes.
You supported this little boy.
Yes.
And changed his life.
Yeah.
And you still talk.
Yes. All the way through. Normally when they leave the Compassion Project, which is after 15 or 20, whatever number of years it is, you lose contact with the child. But we made a commitment. We actually saw him just as he was leaving the project. We actually visited him in Rwanda and met him for the first time. And he wanted to go to university to get further training. So we said, right, we'll continue to support you. So we supported him through his university days. He came out with skills, obviously. And he's made this amazing transformation from just a young boy who's now almost my size. And it was an amazing transformation. And this was one thing that we didn't want to see happen. If we just basically said to him at the end of his time with Tearfund or Compassion, whatever, that they have a chance they'll go back into poverty again, because they'll be given a dream, but if their circumstances are not changed and their lifestyle isn't changed for the better, then they could very easily go back to where they were before. And we were determined that Daniel actually had so much potential that we could see him doing better things with his life.
And his dad's been in jail all this time?
Yes. Yeah.
What a amazing thing you've done, and it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, that was just one. We've got children all around the world. We've got them in South America who are married now with their own families. We've got one that we still speak to all the time, Laura. She's in Colombia. She's at university. Another one went to university, is now married with two children. So we've had a lot of children that we've actually been able to support and increase. Go beyond the call just to help them extend their capabilities. And that's one of the things that I really, really love, is seeing God's potential in children reach their full potential. you know, you have children who start playing the violin or the piano, and I'd give my bottom teeth to play the pan flute because I had one. And I had this beautiful, beautiful pan flute. It was the most magnificent pan flute you've ever seen in your life. And I tried and I tried and I tried and I tried to play it, and I could not play it. I tried to find people to play it, and I couldn't find it. So I sold it to a man who was about the same age as me. I don't know whether he's ever played it, but this pan flute was no good for me because I couldn't do it. But when you see children with skills and talents and abilities that God has given them, and all of a sudden they give it up, and I just can't understand it. No. I just cannot understand it.
No. What? It's a Christian thing to do this, isn't it?
Well, I believe it comes from the Christian faith, where you want to see the best in people. You want to show love to people. You want to show compassion to people. You want to be able to care for people. It's just something that I think goes back to parent days, where it was inbred in a generation like you and I have been through, that you did the right thing and you wanted to help.
And in a good life, those kids are the best part, right?
Absolutely. And Harriet was one that Delaney had, this little girl, so we said, we're going to go and see her. So I went to see her. Delaney and a friend went through to Greece, and they were up in Greece, and I went through via Africa to go and see Daniel in Rwanda and Harriet in Uganda. So I went to see Harriet and saw where she was living. She was living on a floodplain with her mum. Her dad had died because he drank contaminated swamp water. The tap in the village, or the spread out people, they use a communal tap. And the washer or the bolt had broken. The bolt had actually broken, so they couldn't pump the water. So they had to resort to using water that was lying on the ground. Of course, animals contaminate water. A lot of people think that all of Africa is like a giant zoo with all the animals running around. It's not. You have areas like the Kalahari or some of the big reserves. You'll see zebra, gemsbok, springbok. You'll see elephants. You'll see all the big five. You'll see all those animals. But there's a lot of Africa, and in this particular area, where you don't see. I've never seen an elephant or a giraffe, for example, in the wild, anywhere near the village where we were in Uganda. They're not there. So anyway, he died at the age of 39 and left an extended family of probably 8 or 9 people dependent upon him to survive. And they live on a floodplain. They have a wet season where 7 or 8 months of the year, their mud hut is underwater. You can't imagine how tough it is. If you could imagine living in your bathroom or in your little wee unit that you're telling me off air that you're making, you imagine 9 people in there, who live in there and cook in there. They have a chimney that basically isn't a chimney at all. The smoke goes out the front door type of thing. It is really, 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 really hard. And Harriet was this little girl that we sponsored. So I said to Delaney after I came back, I said, we've got to do something about this. We want to build a house, just a basic house, nothing flash, off the floodplain for this family. So we did. We basically got money together and we built a house. And while I was there, had a really, really strong connection with the Kaduku Christian Community Church, just a small church, but such wonderful people, loving, kind, generous. They'd feed you, and you know that the food that they're having, they were going without themselves. It was a beautiful situation. So I said to them, they had this building with this old mixer. It must have been a World War II mixer. It was old as the hills. It didn't work. And I said, what do you use this for? Oh, we used to make bread. And I said, do you know how to make bread? They said, yes, we do know how to make bread, but we don't have a mixer. So I went back and I thought, right, let's make a bakehouse for these people. So we raised money. We raised thousands of dollars, actually. Delaney went along, and we built this this bakehouse. And the upshot of it all is they make about 1,000 loaves of bread a day. They give back to the community. It gives 14 bakers and their support staff. We got a little van that we imported from Japan. That was quite a story how it got there. And they give out, and they give so much to the poor as well. During COVID, they saved literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people's lives because they basically gave bread away. One of the things with the equipment, we had to have a big mixer. So Delaine went to the local New World just in Omru, and she basically went in and swiped a little card, her New World card or Countdown card. I'm not sure which one it was. I think it was Countdown. And she just bought some things for me, and we got a ring a few weeks later saying that she'd won $10,000.
Wow.
It was five people in New Zealand through swiping this card. No skill or anything involved, just swiping this card. So we knew, well, we could knock our mortgage quite substantially, or we could give it to the bakehouse. And it was, without any shadow of a doubt, going to go to the bakehouse. We both said immediately, we know what we're going to use this for. And so it went to the bakehouse to buy equipment. And so there have been miracles all the way through. In more recent times, I've spoken publicly to various groups and organizations, and all of a sudden somebody come out and say, hey, we would like to donate something specifically for this project that you're doing. So from that, that was great. So we were coming back in 2018 from overseas. We'd been to Uganda, we'd been to Rwanda, we're coming back to retire. We had no idea what we were going to do for the rest of our lives. And all of a sudden, I got this email. We're sitting in an island off in Greece, and we got this message that said, I've got very severe health issues from a friend, got very severe health issues. I'm giving $50 a month. Is there any chance that you could help by paying my part, because I'm not working now and I don't know whether I'm going to live? And I said, yeah, I can see that us doing that. That's not a problem. So we set up an automatic payment. And the moment we got back, we then had a look at this whole operation of what was being done for an orphanage over there. And it was a man who basically loved kids, had been an orphan himself, took children and taught them basic English or basic education and fed them and, you know, just basically looked after these a small number of children. So anyway, long story short, we set up an orphanage. The orphanage now has 172 children. One of the problems that we had to also build a school because we couldn't put 172 children by law. We had to school them. We had to actually educate them. So it was going to cost too much for them to go through the official government channels. So we said, right, let's build a school. So they made bricks. They made 28,500 mud bricks and about 25,500 concrete blocks. And we built a 7-classroom school. And now these kids are at school in the orphanage. They get fed. We're a completely legitimate, legalized New Zealand charity. We are told that we're one of the very, very few, if not the only one, that gives almost 100% of every dollar donated gets to the children in Uganda. There's no fees, no costs. They're all absorbed by ourselves. Our rate of delivery is 99.9%. We're also legally set up with the Inland Revenue Department, so the charity, the donation is tax deductible for people on salaries. They can deduct it as a donations rebate. So it's a real win-win situation. Mm-hmm. The sad thing about this is that we've got a very, very small funding base. We've got about 20 people who give between one person gives an amazing $4,000 a month. And other ones are $30 a month, $20 a month, $5 a month, whatever it may be. And every month, last year, we sent across just over 105,000 New Zealand dollars. So we're very, very small, but we are making a huge difference over there.
So for listeners who love the story and would love to contribute, how do they do that?
Well, they can look on the website, The website is www.makemynamecount.org. It's makemynamecount.org. And the reason for that is the fact that make my name count, it means everybody, just anybody can make their name count. It's not me personally, it's everybody. And I've always believed by giving a small amount of money regularly does make a huge difference. And we've been so blessed, and these children are so blessed. If you go over and see them, I was over there in 2022 and saw the operation to make sure everything was going well. We've had to go through lots of hoops to get all the accreditations correct and everything else, make sure everything is done legally and efficiently, complying to Ugandan law as well as New Zealand law. And we've just been blessed. But there's so much as these children grow older. And over there, Rodney, they go to the age of 22. So they have to be taught to the age of 22. So it's a long commitment. And the next task, of course, is what are we going to do when these 172 children reach their exit date from having to go to school? What jobs are there available? How do they integrate into the small area? Now, if I can just tell you a little bit about Kibali, that's where the orphanage is. It's in an area about 25, 30 kilometres away from the Rwandan border. It's not too far away from the Democratic Republic of Congo border, which is always volatile. The Rwandan border does have skirmishes, so it's in quite a tricky area. It's one of the most impoverished areas of Africa. It's at an altitude of 6,500 metres, which means it gets cold. So, and it has 7 to 8 months a year of wet season. And when it rains, it floods. So when the power goes off, the power can go off for 14 days until they find the poles that went down the river. It's quite dramatic. And when you have 172 little children, some of them, five of them have HIV, AIDS, so that means medication. We often have children with high degrees of asthma and also malaria. So we have hospitalizations quite regularly as well. So it's a real balancing act to actually be able to support these children over there as well. But by the grace of God and the generosity of a small number of people, it's making a huge difference.
I'm on your webpage, Lindsay. I'm talking to Lindsay Walker, and we've got this amazing projects in Uganda. And your webpage is makemynamecount.org. What a beautiful webpage. What beautiful pictures. It's worth just looking at it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And this is a charity that you can give to because you're donating your time and money.
Yes.
So that if I give a dollar, it goes to get to Uganda.
It does, in its entirety. And that's the key thing, and that's the thing that appeals
to so many people. That's
unique. Yeah, it is.
I love the bakehouse.
It is. They do things so well. I mean, it's not just a little ramshackle hack. It is so well made. And that's another thing we are looking for people if they can
look
help
at us. These kids at school. And they're so black. And then there's such colourful clothes.
Yes.
And they're so happy.
They are.
Every
month I write a little blog. The last one's about me trying to rescue a giraffe out of a tree, which is quite interesting. But I talk about the smiles. And that's the thing, when you go over there and see these children and see the huge warmth. I mean, we've taken over toothpaste, we've taken over toothbrushes, we've taken over pencils and rubbers and rulers. Because this is very low tech. They haven't got laptops. They haven't iPads. They don't have iPhones. They don't have anything like this. They have the very basics of things, similar to when we're at school. You know, there was lined paper and, pencils and pens and rulers and things. This is what they do. But they're so blessed and they're so grateful. And Kogan and Medius, the people that we love very much, they are the ones who are directing these children. We have.
I'm reading about Kogan's story now. How do you say his surname?
With difficulty.
Pogan Tum Wizzy Gee.
That's it. Very close.
Pogan is a university graduate with a pastoral calling. He turned down a career to care for orphans.
Yes.
Many of whom were found dumped in the road near his home.
Yes.
And they were left there to perish.
Yeah. We don't know a lot of the histories of these children. In fact, they all got a birthday. We know their ages roughly, but it's a bit like the racehorses. I think the racehorses have their 1st of February or 1st of March, whatever is their birthday. So they don't have birthdays, but we bless them with gumboots and clothes, and they're just so grateful.
He has a love for children.
Yes, he does. He's got two of his own now. Beautiful wife.
And has a huge heart.
Yeah.
From just a few orphan children in 2007 to the current number of 172.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It is. Well, we're just so blessed because we know God is in this. We know God has called us to do this. And we're just ordinary, everyday people. And we've just been, if we have the X factor, it's because God has made us extraordinary. And I say that in humbleness because we don't go seeking fame and fortune. We're just there to do as we're told. And we're told to do this. We've been given a gift to do this. And we're just so blessed to do this.
What beautiful children.
Mm. Oh, if you went over there, you want to bring them all home with you, I tell you.
And they would be dead now.
Yes. I know for a fact, and Kogan has told me this, he said there have been children who died that he was looking after. COVID did not kill huge numbers of Ugandans. Starvation did. They shut down the districts within the borders, not only the borders with Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, but they also closed district borders down. And you could see milk being dumped because it couldn't go from one area to another. And you knew darn well that this was vital to keep people alive. And this is the sad thing.
And that was because of COVID restrictions. COVID restrictions did that.
That was COVID restrictions. That just made life even more difficult. It's difficult enough for so many people. And this area is one of the most difficult that I've ever seen. It is really, really harsh. I was over there in the dry season. They don't have winters and summers. They have wet and dry seasons. And it was like being on the West Coast when the West Coast misty days, perhaps spring, perhaps early spring or late winter. It was cold. You know, it was 10 or 11 degrees, but these little kids are running around with bare feet. They have only one jacket. They only have a pair of pants and a shirt. They're not opulent. They're basically survival. They're surviving. And it's really, really hard because we have so much. So there's 62 things that we send over per month, different categories of things. Maize flour. Maize flour used to come from Ukraine, used to come from the Middle East, now doesn't. If it does, it comes via Turkey and Egypt, and it's costing an absolute fortune. It's gone up 50% since the Ukrainian war. And so it goes on. You know, we have staff to pay. We've got schools to run, There's lots and lots of things. Even just pads for the older girls. I mean, these are things that people don't understand, but you've got to pay for those when you have children like that in an orphanage. Medication. And, of course, we grow our own crops. We've got to pay to rent land, and so we rent land. We own a little bit of land, but we rent land. And we've got to grow crops. If we don't grow crops or the crops fail, these kids could die. So it's a real juggling act. And it causes quite a bit of stress and strain just to make sure this goes through.
Many people your age, retired couple in their 70s, play bridge, do a round of golf. go for cruises. You're on a mission.
Yes. Yeah.
And you've got 172 children who depend upon you.
Yes. I often feel I'm like that little mouse that runs around that little wee thing, you know, the little wee round Ferris wheel thing. But I feel like that sometimes. The faster you run, the more dizzier you get.
And you can't falter, can you?
No.
It must be amazingly gratifying, but also terrifying.
Yes, there's a very, very thin line. I compare it with what they go through, and I know that their life is harder than mine. I know that for Kogan, for example, Medius, his wife, his beautiful sister, her beautiful sister was murdered. She was the most beautiful. I think you might see in one of my blogs a photograph of her. She was murdered in a robbery that went wrong. She supplied the children. She was a business lady over there, had a little bit of money. She gave all the money that she had spare for the school uniforms. And her life was taken at a very, very young age. I look at what they go through and the hardships they have to endure, and what would it be like looking after all these children and the lights are out during the night and it's raining outside with huge amounts of rainfall, flooding issues, wet firewood, having to bake porridge for the children, which is their staple diet. And I think my life is so much more blessed. Why am I complaining? Why am I feeling down like a duck? I shouldn't be. I should be getting up there and doing even more than what I'm doing. But I know that if I had a lot more people, it would mean that we could do a lot more to help. And it's going to be a challenge in the future because, as I say, what do you do with 172 children? You can't put them, for example, send them off to Kampala, the capital, or Entebbe or Masaka or one of these other places, because they'd become street urchins. They'd sell SIM cards for 5 cents each, and they have to survive in it. They get into trouble, or could get into trouble. So, you know, these children are God-fearing children. They've given their lives to the Lord. They've become Christian. They're just really beautiful little children, and we want them to stay that way. We want them to have a future. It's no good me giving them a dream and then all of a sudden cutting that dream off. We've got to extend that dream. And it's been the same with Harriet. It's been the same with Daniel in Rwanda and all these other children that we've been blessed to have through what started as a dollar a day, that their lives have been extended and made something really, really special.
The blog that you write looks wonderful.
Thank you.
Well,
comes from the heart.
Yes. The greatest man that ever lived loved the children.
That's right. He sure did. He loves widows and he loves orphans. So the widows, I don't have any, but I do have the responsibility for a large number of children. And I'm really blessed to do that.
We've been talking to Lindsay Walker, who, along with his wonderful wife, Delmaine, did I get that right?
Delaine. That's it.
Have 172 children to look after. If you want to read about them, go to makemynamecount.org. I promise you, you won't be able to look at that without tears of joy and happiness. And you'll want to contribute. Lindsay, it's been a wonderful gift and a blessing to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'd like to have you back and to talk more about the children.
Yes.
And the place.
Very happy to do that.
And I'll compose myself.
You don't have hard. To. You look great.
It's hard, isn't it?
It is hard. Absolutely. Yeah.
You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Please send us a text at 2057. Email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. And please, whatever you do today, go and visit this wonderful webpage, makemyname count, all one word, .org. You'll be so much the better for it. Thank you for listening.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.